corn plants genetically altered to keep away pests, human eggs fertilized in test tubes, tomatoes that don't get squishy. Is science moving too fast without public input? I'm Carolyn Elliott. This is With Good Reason. Researchers are using new technology to speed the wonders of science to an almost dizzying pace. While physicians are treating diabetes, for example, geneticists are looking at ways to replace the defective gene that caused the disease in the first place. But as researchers manipulate the very building blocks of our biological and physical universe, is the public being left in the wake? My guests today say science progresses better and more responsibly when the public is informed and has a voice in regulating research. Historically, the public has found its voice only after research has begun. In the 1970s, with nuclear power, for example, eventually protesters shut the industry down. And again, in 1993, at George Washington University in Washington, D.C., a two-cell human embryo was separated by researchers. When the embryos were then allowed to develop independently, again, protesters shut the work down. Later in the show, we'll visit the Jones Clinic for Reproductive Science in Norfolk to look at advances in in vitro fertilization procedures and challenges facing that industry. In the studio with me now are Doris Salen, Associate Professor of Science Studies and Humanities at Virginia Tech. She's author of Science and Morality, New Directions in Bioethics. Also Brian Ballow of UVA. His book, Chain Reaction, looks at the history of the nuclear power industry. Both are fellows for the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities and Public Policy. Thank you both for joining me.
Glad to be here.
Nice to be here.
Brian, you've written a book about the history of the nuclear power industry, and you suggest that nuclear reactors were developed by a very close scientific community. Do you think we would have had nuclear reactors at all if the public had been more involved from the beginning?
Yeah, actually, I think we would have, and in fact, I think there might be a better chance that we would have nuclear power in the nation's future. As you know, no nuclear power plants have been started for some time in this country, and I think that had the public been brought in from the beginning and made aware of the risks along with the benefits, some of the blind faith that they placed first off in their government and secondly in scientists and experts might have been tempered by kind of more reasonable expectations, the understanding that sometimes things go wrong, sometimes things cost more, but they would have been, or representatives of the public would have been, more full players.
Brian, do you think that some of the secrecy that was attendant to the development of nuclear power is related to the fact that it emerged from the war and the effort to build the bomb from which we got the Atoms for Peace program? Do you think the environment was different then because of the secrecy that the war required?
I think that's definitely the substantive reason for the secrecy in the first 5 to 10 years of commercial nuclear power's development. But what's really quite remarkable about the nuclear community is how that secrecy continued long after any substantive concerns. And even today, hundreds of thousands of documents dating from the late 1940s relating to the peaceful use of commercial nuclear power are still classified in the Department of Energy.
Most of us don't remember that time. What year period are you talking about? And can you give us an example of some of the things that were kept very secret?
Sure. In 1947, the nation decided to found a civilian agency to develop both the military and the peaceful uses of nuclear power. Over the next 5 years or so, the Atomic Energy Commission, that civilian agency, began to develop, or at least began to do research on reactors that would produce nuclear power that in turn would produce electricity. Examples of the kinds of things that were kept secret from the public, the best examples are examples of really quite strong controversy among the small group of nuclear promoters and regulators themselves, the public never saw that there was any kind of internal debate about the safety of nuclear-powered. A man who's not usually associated with conservative approaches to science, Edward Teller, wanted to put all nuclear reactors underground. He felt that that would be the only way that they would be truly safe. The industry, of course, objected to that. To put them underground would clearly make them commercially non-competitive. Really, the only public officials that were intimately aware of these kinds of debates were the elected officials who served on the Joint Committee on Atomic Energy, the one and only Congressional Oversight Committee.
I'd like to look for a moment at the legacy of nuclear power. One of the things that we're dealing with today is still, we don't know where we're going to eventually store all of this nuclear waste. A site was chosen in Yucca Mountain, Nevada in 1987 to store waste, and nuclear power companies are holding on to the waste until that site opens, but the date keeps being put off.
Yeah, well, putting off the date for dealing with some of the messy side effects of nuclear power is nothing new to that field. Going all the way back to the late 40s, you can find really quite elaborate discussion of what should be done with nuclear waste. The gist of it always was, we don't need to worry about it because we will develop some kind of scientific or technological process for dealing with it by the time we need to. Well, that time has long since passed, and we still are not completely sure as to whether the techniques suggested are really going to work. And we certainly know that they may not be up to handling all of the waste that nuclear power and weapons have already created.
Yeah, the 70-ton storage capacity planned for Yucca Mountain was supposed to be ample well into the 21st century, but now predictions are that when the site finally does open, it will fill by the year 2015. Both of you, how can the public, you say that the public should be participating in science, the public should be participating in debates in science. A lot of us look at a situation like this. We have all this radioactive waste. It frightens people. And the public doesn't really know what they should be doing to be an active participant in developing policies.
Obviously, people are going to be quite concerned. Nobody wants anything imposed without their consent, without their ability to contribute to the decision. So I think what has to be established are mechanisms of bringing people together to make decisions and not imposing anything. That's hard to do.
What would you recommend for this particular situation, the buildup of radioactive waste and the correct way to dispose of it?
Well, that's a big question. I notice the French don't seem to have as big a problem with it. French government has, or the French, in France, about 70%, I think, of their electrical power is produced by nuclear energy. And they seem to have built into this process decisions about dealing with the waste, and they use vitrification and other kinds of storage processes. I don't know how successful they are, but they don't seem to have evoked the same kind of reaction as occurred in this country. One of the problems was that no one thought about the waste issue. Certainly the commercial nuclear power industry didn't see it as their problem. As I understood it, I thought the government owned the waste, and therefore the government was going to take care of it at some point when the technology was
Certainly all of the waste that has been generated by weapons production is clearly the government's responsibility. Much historically of the waste, you're quite right, was from radioactive fuel lent to the reactors, so technically the government owned it. At a certain point, the government actually began to sell this. I think the question's a little difficult in the case of waste, because this is a classic example of the public finding out about the problem decades after the program was already in place.
Were they lied to? Were they misled?
Oh, yeah. You can find examples of being lied to and misled, and the public being misled. But I'd like to stress that for the first 25 years of nuclear power's history, The public had much greater confidence in it than many scientists and experts. It was a general public attitude and confidence towards experts and government.
Where is nuclear power today?
Nowhere.
Well, elaborate on that a little bit. And I guess we should say also that the reason that radioactive waste is a problem is because it has a very long half-life. In other words, the stuff stays radioactive for thousands of years, and therefore storage is difficult. But it's nowhere, and you...
It's nowhere. I mean, to just briefly run over the history, it was clear that by the mid-70s, a large segment of the American public was beginning to have some doubts about the safety of nuclear power. There had not been a major accident at that point. What had happened was that some of the internal debate within the nuclear community was beginning to become public, genuine debate. We should do it this way or that way. Simply having a group of experts for the first time disagreeing with each other in public unnerved the American public. I would argue because they had been so left out of the process for the first 20 years. You know, the interesting thing is there was an accident in 1961 that killed three people in a nuclear reactor. It was at a testing plant out west in Idaho, as I recall. And if you look at the press coverage, there was an article about it the day afterwards in the New York Times. And by the second day, you really had to go to page 17 in a one-paragraph article to see anything. No one was killed at Three Mile Island, yet obviously that accident had a colossal impact on public opinion. What began as quite serious doubts among the public by the mid-70s was reinforced by the Three Mile Island accident at the end of that decade, and then perhaps the final nail in the coffin of commercial nuclear power was hammered home by the Chernobyl accident. Rightly or wrongly, there's good reasons to distinguish the reactors at Chernobyl from most commercial nuclear power reactors, but that's not how the public interpreted the news by the time that they were already predisposed towards distrusting certainly the nuclear industry, and I think in larger terms, scientific and technological efforts.
Well, Doris, you're committed to bringing the public into debate on science issues. In fact, you hold forums in Blacksburg on topics ranging from diet and disease to nuclear power to genetic engineering. Tell us a little bit about those forums and tell us what kind of response you get.
The forums are called Choices and Challenges because the advances in science and technology present us with a lot of choices, and they also present us with some problems and some challenges. And we have about 500 to 600 people coming to the Blacksburg site, and we have distant sites around the country. Last time, over 130 sites. And we feel that by holding these forums and bringing together a large public audience, a very diverse background, we can create an environment in which the issues can be discussed, evaluated, and even some of the problems addressed. So we bring together scientists and technologists who can explain what's going on in the different areas that are under scrutiny. We bring together historians who can tell us how we've come to think about these issues, what has been the history of policy, or what has been our history of dealing with these issues. We bring together philosophers and ethicists who can begin to show us what some of the ethical dilemmas are and how we might go about trying to solve them. And sociologists who look at the public impact.
So even on complicated issues that most people don't understand, I mean, the things that we're talking about, nuclear power, and we'll be talking with you about DNA, the public, most people in the public, really don't have a great understanding of what a gene is, where it's found, how you clip the chromosome to switch genes, and they don't have a clear
understanding. Do you understand how your car runs? I mean, I don't understand how my car runs terribly well. Yet I manage to purchase a car, and I'd like to believe that that decision, which costs me a lot of money, is an informed one.
Yeah, exactly. I think one doesn't have to have a PhD and years of experience in a scientific area to have the expertise to make decisions about how it's going to be used. We can easily explain to people how a nuclear reactor works and the fact that there are wastes produced and the lifetime of these wastes. We can explain what a chromosome is and how it functions. And that's the easy part. The hard part is, how do we deal with it? What policies do we follow? What areas do we pursue?
Well, you've been part of a very successful committee, the Recombinant DNA Advisory Committee, which in 1973, the scientific community actually became concerned about the progress of genetic engineering research, and they actually stopped themselves. They put a moratorium on themselves and said, we can't go forward with any more of this research until we've got some rules and some guidelines.
Well, the issue at first was one of safety. If now you had the capacity to manipulate genetic material, to move genes around, to take genes from plants and put them into bacteria, or genes from humans and put them into viruses, could you inadvertently be creating an organism that would be so devastating, that would cause a disease or a problem that was so horrible, that you couldn't really rein it back in, you couldn't control it? So the fears initially in the scientific community were, and in the general community, were what could might you be producing that you hadn't intended to, that might cause great personal health or environmental damage? And so when the Recombinant DNA Advisory Committee, which whose initials are RAC, so we call it the RAC, when the RAC was established in 1974, its mission was really to decide how could we go ahead with this kind of research and yet protect the health and safety of the scientists and researchers who were working on it and the wider community within which this research was going on.
And the RAC is made up of?
The RAC is made up of scientists, of clinicians, and of people who represent the general public, though nobody is elected. There are ethicists, there are people who are very well versed in science policy, in political science, in sociology, people who work with patients with rare disorders, people who can represent various and diverse public views about gene therapy. But also, the RAC meets in a public audience. All its meetings are announced in advance, and several hundred people show up to each RAC meeting to contribute their ideas, and they're allowed to speak and show their concerns or advocate certain kinds of approaches, and they are listened to.
My understanding is any federally funded human gene therapy program has to make a presentation before the RAC before they can do experiments on humans.
Well, gene therapy is sort of the logical extension of genetic engineering. Originally, genetic engineering was the viruses and bacteria. Then it moved up the evolutionary ladder a little bit, and we have transgenic animals that have been designed to carry out certain very useful functions.
Well, you have one at Virginia Tech.
Yes,
Genie the pig.
Yes, we do.
Right, actually, has been engineered to create a something that clots human
blood.
Yes,
a human protein, which is very hard to produce otherwise. And this is a system, a way of producing this protein that could be very helpful for people with clotting disorders. But gene therapy has always been the dream of people in medicine because there are many diseases and disorders that have a genetic cause. One small gene, one of the tens of thousands of genes that we have, may malfunction. And when that happens, the person can get very sick. And medical science has always wanted to be able to do the ultimate treatment, which is to correct the problem at the level of the gene, to put in a normal gene. But this was really only a dream for decades, until the era of genetic engineering. And it's become possible now to isolate the normal gene for many disorders such as cystic fibrosis or Tay-Sachs disease or PKU disease, and to begin to think about putting that normal gene back into the body of the person who has the defective or malfunctioning gene. And we saw approved our first protocol in 1991. There have been about 100 experiments that have been approved.
And occasionally, I assume experiments are turned down.
Yes, the RAC is only advisory, and that is, any decision it makes is forwarded to the director of the National Institutes of Health, and the director of the National Institutes of Health has the final word. Also, the FDA is involved, and it, in a parallel pathway, it works with the investigators in terms of the safety of the materials that are used and put into people's bodies. The FDA, however, carries out all of its deliberations in private.
And as a matter of fact, there are some companies that are now kind of bypassing the RAC and getting approval through the FDA, which they can do if they're private companies and they're not receiving any federal funding.
But all these organizations voluntarily came to the RAC, and the RAC looked at their proposals and made recommendations and decisions on their behalf. So there was a lot of voluntary compliance by commercial interests.
Well, let's take the last few minutes here and look at some real scientific questions that are facing the public. A lot of the issues are not as much are scientific, but they're also moral. For example, fetal tissue research.
Well, I think that that's a classic example of a political or moral question. And I think that you need to leave that up to the political process so that all you need to do in that case is ensure that it gets a fair hearing, a fair debate in the appropriate political forum for elected officials, and it undoubtedly will end up in the court system as well, which, you know, is one of the branches of our democracy.
I'm a little nervous about letting the courts get into this because We've seen a whole lot of delay. The court system is very slow, and scientific issues often need a rather rapid turnaround in terms of response.
What if the public decides they want something stopped? Can you really stop the progress of science?
Yeah, you can stop. If something is considered so objectionable or so preliminary that the public feels it needs more information and wants things stopped, I think it will stop research. And we can cite a number of examples. The moratorium on cloning research that's going on now, even though there's no official prohibition against it, the investigators who produced a very early kind of cloning have had to shut down their research because of public objections to it.
The ALR scare with apples, irradiation of produce, their most recent scare over the growth hormone found in milk. A lot of those things caused an initial panic and ended up being not really that much of an issue also. So that tends to happen in the public too.
Yeah. Well, one partial solution to the problem is simply time. If, in fact, an issue is serious and the public is aware of it, the odds are that the protest will be persistent.
Carol, what's impressed me through the years of working with the public in Choices and Challenges is that people really want to do the right thing. They want to understand what the real risks and benefits of something are. They want to let useful research go on, and they endorse that very strongly. And they really want to reduce illness and discomfort and environmental distress in the world. People really want to make wise decisions. And if they're given the opportunity and the information, I think they can do that.
I would just endorse that, and I would say that over the long run, we have run into far more trouble denying information and denying participation to the public than allowing that information to be disseminated and encouraging the public to participate.
Doris Salen, Brian Ballow, thank you so much for joining me on With Good Reason.
My pleasure.
Great fun. Thanks.
Brian Ballow and Doris Salen are fellows of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities in Public Policy. Dr. Salen's new book, Does It Run in the Family?, about genetic testing, will be released next year. As my guest pointed out, new advances in science are often accompanied by new ethical dilemmas. Take the case of Renee and David Abshire. The couple had a daughter who died in 1989 at age 3 from Tay-Sachs disease. The Abshires' desire for another baby was complicated by the fact that the couple is pro-life, and in a normal pregnancy, Tay-Sachs couldn't be diagnosed until amniocentesis, and then the choice would be abortion or watching another child die. So they chose to undergo in vitro fertilization at the Jones Clinic for Reproductive Medicine at Eastern Virginia Medical School in Norfolk, where researchers can now pull cells from a cultured human embryo to screen DNA for genetic defects. Dr. William Gibbons is chair of the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the Jones Clinic.
This is the laboratory that contains the special microscopes and the specially equipped micromanipulation equipment that allows us to biopsy the embryo. biopsying the embryo means that we will take a 6-cell, 7-cell, or 8-cell embryo and remove one of the cells.
Of the 13 eggs Renee Abshire produced, 7 were successfully fertilized in a petri dish. In this lab, in a procedure that Gibbon says doesn't harm any of the developing embryos, doctors took cells from 4 of Abshire's embryos. Then the search began for defective genes for Tay-Sachs, cystic fibrosis, and other genetic diseases. The chromosomes for 1 cell carried Tay-Sachs. The other 3 were implanted in Renee's uterus.
It has only been in the last 2 to 3 years that these techniques have been utilizable for this procedure. And so at the time, for instance, when Brittany Abshire was born, she, in 1994, she was one of 8 children in the world who had been screened for a single gene defect such as Tay-Sachs.
Baby Brittany Abshire recently celebrated her first birthday. The Jones Institute has been on the cutting edge of in vitro processes since the first test tube baby was cultured in a petri dish here in 1980. Last year, more than 500 couples sought in vitro at the clinic. Only a small percentage underwent the pre-implantation screening. Others chose the clinic for another reason. The Jones Institute has a high success rate for freezing embryos, or cryopreservation, which allows the embryos to be kept on ice. With this process, fewer eggs are implanted in the mother, significantly reducing the number of twins and triplets born to in vitro couples.
And so this means that we have the opportunity for a woman to come back if she conceives or if she doesn't conceive at a later time. We can thaw the embryos that we have not put back into the uterine cavity, and she will have a chance to have more embryos placed back into the uterine cavity without having any further ovulation induction surgery to obtain the eggs or whatever. And so it increases the number of embryo transfers without it really changing the cost very much.
Ultimately, this process, however, results in leftover frozen embryos, which has stirred a controversy in bioethics.
There is a loophole with in vitro fertilization. Of course, one has to create many embryos. And what happens with those embryos?
Fiona Givens is communications director for the Virginia Society for Human Life, a branch of the National Right to Life Committee, the largest pro-life organization in the U.S.
We have this incredible power now to create life, and it's a slippery slope. And we feel that it is completely barbaric to then use that human life to further research in whatever area.
Recently, President Clinton approved giving federal grants to perform research on embryos that are already in existence, like those created by in vitro processes. The ethics committee at the Jones Clinic hasn't decided to apply for such a grant, says Dr. Gibbons, but the clinic has received approval to experiment on embryos with genetic defects to improve the freezing process.
I've described to you that the embryos from a couple who have a lethal gene defect, that we would not transfer back the lethally affected embryos. We will utilize those embryos, however, for that couple in trying to improve the cryopreservation process. And so we can try to improve the chance that that all embryos will survive the cryopreservation procedure to try to offer these couples more healthy kids.
With Clinton's new policy, the 100 or so in vitro clinics in the country may be eligible for some federal funding for the first time. They also face some regulations. While the Jones Clinic boasts a high success rate of 30%, other clinics report few pregnancies. 2 years ago, in response to public demand, Congress required clinics to begin filing reports on their success rates, but the mandate to date has not been funded. This is With Good Reason. On our next show, guest host David Andelman looks at religion in 2 volatile political contexts, Christianity in China and Muslim upheaval in Hindu India. The project coordinator for With Good Reason is Michael McDowell. John Wilkinson is the assistant producer. We had production assistance from Julie Boland. Kevin Puccini wrote the theme music. I'm Carolyn Elliott. This program was produced with the help of WCVE Richmond. Thanks also to WVTF Roanoke.
With Good Reason is produced for the Virginia Higher Education Broadcasting Consortium by the State Council of Higher Education and public radio stations serving Virginia. The views expressed are not necessarily those of the consortium or this station. To comment on today's program or to receive tapes or transcripts, call toll-free 1-800-245-2434.